I'm very grateful to be a discussant for these two papers. I actually prepared to talk about Jayati's paper too, because I think there is a possibility of an integrated view of all three papers. And this is, and I guess what I wanted to do is not really to ask pointed questions at Jayati's paper and Rania's paper, but to try to bring a consolidation, and maybe to ask a few questions that I have in my that I have made notes of. Right, basically the pattern that we can see from these three discussions is the recent domination of finance as the way in which economies work. Right, and this started with and what I found so beautiful about Jayati's paper is that she demonstrated it on a specific issue, right? The specific issue of food prices. The people in the UN here will remember that, about a year ago, this room was full, right? And I was sitting in a small corner over there when there was a global conference on the food crisis, right? And at that time, it wasn't really clear, what the problem with the food crisis was. I mean, whether financial speculation had any role to play, and what Jayati has demonstrated is that, there might be a possible role, and in my case, I seem to be very convinced that there is a role because of this comparison between production and stocks and utilization. Right. The main insight that you would get from some Jayati's work is the following: that in some sense. We have this question that prices of these commodities have been set in other markets or in financial markets, not in the demand and supply markets that actually apply to them. And from a developing country point of view, they're actually set somewhere else, right? So that's one part. The other part is this question of, and this is true in other financial markets that have arisen since the 2000 deregulation, this question that prices can be set in markets by actors that actually have no real position in the price, right? This is true of credit default swaps, because what has happened is that you can actually take a position in credit default swaps, which is where many of the banks abroad have lost their money. Even if you don't hold a credit default swap is the probability that a company is going to go bankrupt, right? Even if you don't hold any debt against that company, you can take a position on credit default swaps. This is the same thing that happened in the food market. You can take a position on the food market even if you're not holding any of the stocks. If you have no claim on any of the stocks. What Jayati's discussion actually shows is that, these kinds of markets, they actually generate confusing price signals, right? Price signals that actually exacerbate the problem, and price signals that actually then, prevent the markets, theoretically, from working out what the shortages are. And she talks about, one, the need for governments to get involved in the production side of this agricultural commodity. And secondly, to figure out ways to regulate these markets. I have some questions that maybe I can bring up here, but mainly these questions are just for purposes of provoking. I mean, mainly for purposes of provoking discussion. The other thing I wanted to say is that the commodity futures markets problems are very much like foreign exchange market problems, which Jayati also mentions as needing to be subject to regulation, right? And we know that in the Asian crisis, the foreign exchange markets were not actually clearing. They were being run by speculation towards one side until something changes, right? So the question I have is, and in effect, many of the presenters preempted some of these questions that I was planning to ask. What does it mean for the international system that one wants to regulate? Food markets, right? The setting of prices in food markets. What does it mean for developing countries in particular. We just yesterday we heard that the United States is willing to put in what I don't remember the number now, $8 billion, right? And for the food crisis, I don't know. I haven't actually looked at the specific proposal, but does it mean then just throwing money into greater food production in the developing countries, or does it mean providing, as Rania intimated, providing providing food supply from the rich countries to the developing countries? And the question I actually thought that we might also mention that wasn't mentioned in Jayati's presentation is the question of the trade regime. Because what actually needs to be really looked at is not just figuring out a way to make either to regulate this market so that they don't set the prices, but deep-seated reform in the rich countries that actually produce a lot of this subsidized food, and the kind of social dislocations that will happen in the developed countries in order to undertake a system that is not dependent on food. The other area of discussion I wanted to bring up is, and this is actually, you know, I'm starting to go into Rania's discussion about whether this crisis should be an occasion for temporary responses or reforms. Maybe they can set a precedent, or whether they should be an occasion for thoroughgoing reform, right? The other question that I think the food crisis brings up is this question of market substituting for rights, basic rights, right? The idea being that the states have managed to lose a lot of the responsibilities that they have in the human rights area because these kinds of obligations are supposed to be met by markets. You know, I mean, for example, the right to water, the right to food, right? And in effect, the way I see it is not just a question of re-regulating the financial markets, and this is implicit in what Jayati has brought up, right? Not just a question of re-regulating the financial markets that seems to set the prices, but changing the way in which the production system is being held, making sure that stable investment occurs in productivity in agriculture, and making sure that the public sector role is secure, right, in that part of the economy that produces and distributes food. So it's like and this is part of the overall discussion about finance and this crisis, it's like a rethinking or a revitalization of the permanent role of the state and rethinking about it in a way in which the state is effective in meeting these obligations and making sure that its obligations as far as its citizens are actually met in a predictable manner. So this then leads me to Rania's question. She called for, in her presentation, it wasn't very clear in the paper itself, but you know, I mean, this is, the paper is a working paper, but she called for actually thoroughgoing reform, right? What I wanted to say is gender-motivated reforms are very complex, right? They require different approaches to re-regulating the economy. They also require redesigning how public monies and public resources are actually sent. And each of these decisions is almost very specific to each country that where it will be done, though we know that there are common what gender research suggests is that there are common characteristics that have to be addressed in all countries. Among the questions that, for example, might be brought up by rethinking the economy on gender terms is this question about demand-led, wage-led growth. Right? We have, a question that maybe is too hard to look at, but maybe it's something to look at. But the question of redirecting domestic demand in many of the products that now have lost export markets, right? Is there any way to think about garments and trade exports to be then, and it's not simple, right? Because what you would then have to do is to rethink not just the gender part of it, but the whole economic system, which generates the kind of demand and the kind of sectoral demand that these industries that used to be export-oriented have to look at. In general, in spite of its complexity, one of the ideas that gender analysis brings up for me is this question of making prominent more universal interventions as opposed to sectoral interventions, right? Like guarantees for employment and all that stuff. Because there are different ways in which women are affected. The main problem is that unless these provisions are provided on a universal basis, a lot of what is actually being captured are only those that can be enforced through markets and market transactions. And we know that women in general have a very large part in non-market or non-official or non-formal parts of the economy, which Dranya's paper is a whole section on. Yeah. The other thing that I wanted to, the last thing that I wanted to bring up, and this is in a sense connected to Rania's discussion in his presentation about policy consistency and coherence, is the fact that I think it's important for us to, when we analyze economies, to think that social protection mechanisms are not just to protect the poor and to rescue the poor. They actually have an important, or they could have, and in many cases they do have, an important role in stabilizing the macroeconomy, right? That they actually reduce the amplitude of cycles, right? So therefore it's really, I mean, it's a gender argument, but it's really an argument too that is required for more stable growth and actually more reliance on the private sector investment, because private sector in real sector, right, not investment in speculative activity, private sector investment really then relies on a stable long-term investment horizon. So this is these are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you to you.